Hey, wahi tapu, wahi arahi mai, inya tahora me inya ahi. Welcome to On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 216. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson, speaking to you now from the top of Memory Island here on Aotea, Great Barrier Island, New Zealand. It's the mid-afternoon of September 21st, 2017. Today is the new moon, and tonight is the spring equinox. So it's a very powerful conjunction of cosmic alignments, sacred moments in time, and I'm lucky to be on atop Memory Island, my probably most powerful spot in all of New Zealand, both in terms of my proximity to the dolphins here, but also the place where I've recorded more On the Brink radio shows than any other single location. Delusion is very popular these days. I remember a friend of mine who's a medical doctor back in the States told me that there was this famous book called The Madness of Crowds, and I always thought that was very interesting. And it seems to me, you know, of course, what someone thinks of as reality is totally different for each person, although we have a lot in common, because if we didn't, how would we be able to live together in the same world? A lot of our reality is, of course, based on our more or less accurate experience and perceptions of the external world that traditionally has not been of human creation, i.e. the world of nature, the natural archetypes of earth, wind, fire, air, cloud, water, stars, rain, fellow beings, animals, plants. But in the world of today, I'd say that people with a grip on anything that I'd call reality are actually few and far between. We sort of specialize in our day-to-day, more or less superficial interaction with other people. And if you just have the normal small talk with people, and that's about as far as most people go, everybody kind of seems, you know, pretty much the same. But I think lying beneath that is a very pervasive and deep-rooted what psychologist Eric Fromm called the pathology of normalcy. And that was in the 1950s. So a big part of my work as a psychological explorer and researcher has been to try to map out quote-unquote reality. Now, there's a lot of complexities to this, reality itself being a word in one language called English. Now, this in itself is an entire psychological dimension that's worth an entire show just devoted to the psychology of language. And given the fact that I'm speaking in English now on this radio show, as opposed to dancing about my topic or making smells about it or singing about it or carving sculptures in honor of it, I'm actually talking about it in English, which is only one of many possible avenues of expression, but it's sort of the commonly accepted one to use on a talk radio show. Understanding our psychological systems is probably the single most important thing that any of us can try to do as a human being in this lifetime, both to come to grips with and realize, understand, and actualize who we really are and what our true innate nature and abilities are, which very few of us are even remotely approximating what these are right now in this era of human incarnation on Mother Earth. But also understanding the inherent limits of our psychology as Homo sapiens, i.e. man the wise. I see the word sapiency a lot in media lately, sapiency, which just makes me think of Homo sapien, man the wise, but sapien. I guess in Latin it means wise, so we're looking at not just intelligence in other beings, but wisdom, theoretically. not just trying to understand our own individual psychology, but also to understand the inherent limits of what it means to be human. Now, I think that in our true, unadulterated form, which we are not in right now, that we actually are the ultimate technology, which is a piece of art and a concept I've developed at length. But because we're so far out of balance with our true nature and what it means to actually live as a biological life form on Mother Earth, we've totally lost most of these abilities and capabilities that are actually our true nature. So trying to understand all this has always been a big part of my work, but especially in the context of my work with, on behalf of, and in my love of the whales and dolphins, who I consider to be a true extraterrestrial intelligence and the ultimate indigenous people. And what better place for me to record a show about them than here atop Memory Island, where I can look down to either my left or my right, to the north and the south, and see the exact little stretches of beach where I've had my two or three most powerful and intensive encounters with dolphins ever in my life over the past few years. And the words, the Maori that I spoke earlier, he wahi tapu, wahi arahi mai, inya tahora me inya ahi, it means a sacred place of guidance from the whales and dolphins. And I really feel that that's where I am. So hopefully their beautiful consciousness is tuning into my presence here and guiding me in what I'm talking about. I'm looking out over the ocean now, constantly looking to see if I see any. They're there. I probably just can't see them. They could crop up right here at any point, even though I'm about probably 20 meters above the ocean, but they'd be very close. We don't really comprehend or deal with reality, and it's like an ever-receding chimera in the hall of mirrors of our mind. Reality, it's like the word language or truth. These are words. People, do you want to understand reality? Well, it's a word consisting of several letters in English. Within my ability to express concepts in English, I would say that the most sensical model that I know of what reality really is, other than that it's fundamentally consciousness and secondarily matter, that matter is a state of consciousness. But beyond that, physicist David Bohm's idea of the implicate and explicate holo movements are to me the best scientific model of reality. So really, that's what we're a part of and what we're processing. But what we perceive and experience as reality is, A, largely a function of our real-time sensory inputs. Vision, hearing, touch, smell, taste, tactile, our sense of being in the gravitational field, our perception of being on the surface of and within the living biosphere of a planet, i.e. Mother Earth, the only planet we know who has life, surrounded by a myriad astronomically diverse plethora of beautiful, improbable life forms of many, many kingdoms of life. Almost all of whom have been here far, 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 and may I add, far longer than us. We're the newcomers on the block, yet we've struggled to promote ourselves to the top of the hierarchical pyramid of overlord dominance, from whose vantage point we look down on other beings and ask ourselves, well, is this being, does it have intelligence or does it have sapiency? To me, this is a salient fundamental characteristic of the distorted, or should I say demented, mental operating environment characterizing modern humanity. Part of my work along these lines with psychology and with the whales and dolphins is to decapitate the juggernaut of anthropocentrism that sort of consciously and unconsciously dominates and permeates our whole worldview, our whole attitude towards other beings and Mother Earth and each other. So we've got many inherent limitations just by our nature as human beings, and that's why it's really interesting to compare the whales and dolphins, because they're very much like us in many ways, but very, very, very different in many other ways. They're mammals who breathe air, give birth to their young, have very advanced central nervous systems and an extra lobe to their brain that no other mammals have. Clearly, the words intelligence have nothing to do with them. They're beyond all that. And language, certainly they don't use language. I've had a bunch of dialogue with people about that. Language means that you use your tongue to speak. They don't do that. They don't use their tongues to make sound. If they're going to make a sound in air, they do it out of their blowhole, which is similar to us trying to speak through our nose. They do that for us. They make sound projecting it through their head in the water in ways, systems of communication so astronomically complex and advanced, they make language look like a primitive, backward, archaic throwback to the days of the ancestors of humans walking on our four legs. I think the whales and dolphins are so advanced, they're much more advanced in their adaptation to where they live than we are. And I keep thinking back on the belief that I've learned is actually shared by a lot of whale-dreaming Aboriginal cultures in Australia, that they know that the whales and dolphins did, in fact, used to live on the land, and they went back to the sea. If you look at the flipper bones of a dolphin, you see almost identical replica of the hand bones of a person. They even got a thumb. It may not be an opposable thumb flattened into the flipper there, but it certainly could have been. And I just really wonder if they gave up the use of hands to return to the sea, a much more safe and stable environment than the land. They've been here 10 to 30 million years. That's 10 to 30 times longer than anything resembling us has been here. So they're light years ahead of us in terms of consciousness, intelligence, the ability to communicate, the ability to live harmoniously and sustainably on this planet, and to understand what it means to be here in many, many, many different ways. But all these are interesting topics, but not the subject of this show. In addition to our own inherent limitations as human beings compared to the whales and dolphins, for example, in modern times we have a new dimension of limitation of our own cognitive abilities, which is the increasing application of our most advanced technologies and social engineering apparatus to influence what other people think of as reality. There's various technological systems, what you might call mass media or mass communication as a whole, all the different forms that it's taken throughout the 21st and then throughout the 20th and into the 21st centuries. But the whole idea of manipulating people goes back thousands of years. Probably it's as old as language itself, which is a very interesting thought. But so in the world of today, not only are we faced with trying to function with an impaired neurocognitive apparatus that's, for many different reasons, a lot of which have to do with our own choices of navigation over the past few thousand years, we've got debilitated cognitive apparatus living in a social reality where the dominant form of communication is that of a small number of privileged minorities, organizations, and people wielding the most advanced technologies and systems of communication and social engineering to influence what everybody else thinks of as reality. And this doesn't mean education. We're talking about hardcore manipulation, lies, deception, psychological warfare, what the Nazi psychiatrist called the Weltanschauungskrieg, which is the origin of psychological warfare. We're living in a very vast and pervasive matrix of this. And so most people's ideas that they walk around with aren't really their own. And one of my favorite things that the people at Adbusters came up with was a t-shirt that said, "The product is you," which is very true. So anyway, this is the introduction to my show today, which is looking at the real global threats to whales and dolphins, which is one of two major dimensions of my overall work with them over the last decades, the other being understanding who they are as fellow beings living on Mother Earth. There's been a lot of misconceptions in the public mind about the whales and dolphins. It's a vast topic in itself. But to understand what the real global threats to them are is very important in the world of today. Just so that we're able to walk around with a reasonably accurate simulation model or picture in our mind of what's really going on, as opposed to a distorted model or picture that does not in any way reflect reality. Not that we're going to be able to do anything about these things that I'm about to mention. Au contraire, I think that it's all out of control so far that for the vast majority of these things I'm about to talk about, we could not stop doing it even if we really wanted to. I mean, theoretically, yes, but because of the different dynamics and driving forces of these truly global systems, it's just not going to happen. A big part of my work and the perspective from which I'm coming in this show is my ongoing challenge to try to learn how to think like a planet. And I'd really like to thank Dr. Claudia von Wehrlauf and her mentor, Dr. Rosalie Bertel, for vast insights along this line. I just talked with Claudia a couple of days ago, and she's too involved in writing her book to do an interview with me. But she's doing some fantastic work along this line. In the spirit of Rosalie Bertel, who was a medical doctor who did some very serious, groundbreaking mapping of the whole global military apparatus. So if we try to think like a planet, that means that we don't just look at an isolated incident of, for example, a threat to whales and dolphins. We don't just look at what's happening off the North Island of New Zealand, for example. We don't just look at what's happening in Japan. We don't look at what's happening in Hawaii or Alaska or off the coast of South America or in the Mediterranean. If we think like a planet, all of these places are part of our body as a planet, if we're thinking like Mother Earth. So if something was disrupting the health of your body at any given point, you'd be aware of all these points at the same time. If mosquitoes were biting you in 50 different places, you'd feel each one of them. And I think that this is how we need to approach trying to think like a planet, because Mother Earth senses, experiences, and feels everything that we're doing everywhere all at once. Our minds are just so small, we can't even begin to grasp this planetary consciousness. I think the whales and dolphins actually share in this consciousness to a vastly higher degree than do we. But that in itself is another topic. But in terms of understanding the real global threats to whales and dolphins, I'm going to start from what is ironically the most highly visible, talked about, and capitalized on threat to whales and dolphins. Yet in reality, of all the direct threats to them that exist, it's the least important. It's so insignificant that it really shouldn't even be included on a list of the real global threats to whales and dolphins. And what I'm talking about is a form of maritime hunting called whaling. Now, whaling has been going on probably for thousands of years in different forms, but it really became an industry in the 1700s or 1800s. And a lot of populations were reduced down very low, the humpback whales. And sure, it's absolutely barbaric. It's like it's targeting an individual being with a giant harpoon and spearing it and letting it pull you in its boat, in your boat, and dying over prolonged periods of time, just in agony. And then, while it's still alive, being hoisted onto the boat so that its meat and blubber can be cut off. I mean, this is a total barbaric atrocity, one of the most diabolical things that humans have ever engaged in. And the people with all the environmental organizations that are making vast amounts of money each year from quote-unquote saving the whales, they love to use the whaling as an example of the, they project it as the single greatest threat to whales in the world, especially the Japanese. And, for example, the people in the Faroes Islands, which is a Danish territory, maybe in Iceland, maybe some Norwegian whalers. And sure, it's barbaric. When people see these evil people that have faces, of course, these evil people going out there ruthlessly hunting down the innocent whales and spearing them and then taking them back and harvesting them for meat and selling their meat in restaurants. And this has been exploited and capitalized on ad nauseum by a number of very well-known organizations whose names I don't need to mention anymore. I've talked about them enough. I won't honor them with a mention of their name. But the actual reality is that technologies and other issues exist in the world's ocean, of which there's only one. Technologies and ongoing processes exist that dwarf whaling by light years of orders of magnitude. And these issues are different from whaling. Whaling involves the targeting of an individual whale with a weapon, whereas all these other issues and technologies operate at the systemic level, directly or indirectly. So I'm going to talk about seven other threats to the well-being of whales and dolphins. I consider to be extraordinarily lethal at this time. This is not necessarily in the order of their importance. They're all the things I'm about to talk about are probably equally severe, except for, after just mentioning whaling, I'll talk about for example, the physical impacts of the human presence in the world's ocean, primarily from boats of different kinds. The physical impacts, you look at the number of boats that exist in the world, whether they're small recreational boats of all kind of different sizes for pleasure, for touring, for surfing, for fishing, to all the commercial vessels of all the different sizes, all the bureaucratic and research vessels of different sizes, all the different shipping vessels, all the different cruise liners, all the different military vessels of the world. So we're probably talking about, I'm just making a rough guess, but in the millions to tens of millions of boats in the water around the world's ocean at any given time. So just the fact that they're there is an impact in itself. They're a big chunk of metal sticking down in the water, and all that that implies. Then you've got their propulsion systems, which is going to be, regardless of what type it is, it's going to be making a lot of noise. Most of them are driven by propellers, unprotected propellers, which are giant cutting blades down in the water. So that's a very big problem for whales and dolphins, is either running into the hulls of boats or getting struck by propellers. Now, this is one of my areas of activism, especially here in New Zealand, but globally, is to create awareness about a technology called a shroud or a propeller guard. That any propeller on any boat can be protected with a shroud, that it might reduce the fuel consumption and top speed by a few percent, but not much, compared to the fact that it would prevent any kind of cutting or striking of a being or an object by the propeller, as well, you know, protecting the life forms in the sea, including people, as well as the propeller itself. So I think that shrouds should be legally mandatory on every propeller in the ocean. The only ones that pretty much have them now are safety and rescue boats that are made to designed to rescue people. But when you look at the shipping lanes, the amount of traffic, these giant boats that populate these shipping lanes, and how many of them there are all around the world, and other issues of, for example, fuel and lubricants leaking, this is all part of the physical dimension of threats to whales and dolphins. Now we step into the more systemic levels, the issues. And again, sort of what I'm doing here, I've made up a new acronym for what I'm trying to do in terms of a holistic modeling at a planetary level. I've come up with a new acronym, HOMO-MIMIC. That's H little O, M little O, M-I-M-I-C. It stands for Holistic Modeling of Marine Impacts for Military Industrial Civilization. So I'm HOMO-MIMICing in my quantitative summation analyses that I'm trying to share with you now. Everything I'm talking about could be quantified at a much higher scientific level, and it's something that I'm really working on, and I've got a few leads in terms of work in this direction that some people have already done. But one of the biggest systemic problems affecting the whales and dolphins, and again, all of the things I'm about to talk about are affecting the well-being and health, not only of the whales and dolphins, but of all the life forms in the ocean. The chemical and radiological toxicity scenario, and I really like to thank my friends at Ocean Alliance, founded by Dr. Ian Kerr and Roger Payne, for their ongoing work. I think their most important contribution to date, beyond Dr. Payne's original paper about humpback whale songs, is their five-year survey of global ocean toxicity using their research vessel, the Odyssey, which was the first global comprehensive study of chemical toxicity. And a drawback was that they somehow chose not to investigate radiological toxicity, which easily could have been done. Later on, Dr. John Wise did venture into studying the effects of depleted uranium, which was most to his credit, but I don't think he's doing it anymore. But the chemical toxicity scenario, if you look at the ocean, that alone, we could talk for hours about that. There's probably, well, to make a point, Ocean Alliance points out in the beginning of their report on their survey that the ocean lies downhill from everywhere on the land, which is a given. But what that means is that all the water from the land eventually flows downhill into the ocean. So that means everything on the land drains into the ocean. not to mention rainfall. So the ocean is where it all ends up. The ocean is the ultimate dumping ground for waste, has been for hundreds or thousands of years, because it's so big. When you dump something in the ocean, it just disappears. Like, and supposedly, a lot of scientists like to think that no matter what it is, it dilutes so severely that no matter what it is, once it's in the ocean, it becomes harmless. So Dr. Roger Payne talked a lot about persistent organic pollutants, endocrine disruptors, PCBs. Supposedly whales have been studied that had such high levels of concentrated contaminants in their body that their flesh would have been declared a toxic, a hazardous waste by the EPA, and yet they were still around swimming alive and functioning. But who knows what kind of effect this might have had on them, especially cognitively. It caused me to surmise the possibility of a cetacean Alzheimer's syndrome, where they were still able to swim around and function, but that their mentality was suffering from dementia. But we'd have absolutely no way of knowing anything about this. So the chemical toxicity thing, I mean, probably studies have been done that give lists of all the known chemical pollutants in the ocean. But there's all kind of stuff, all the heavy metals, mercury. Ocean Alliance found a lot of hexavalent chromium. But the bottom line, and according to Dr. Sylvia Earle, no one should ever eat anything from the ocean because it's so contaminated. But what does that tell you about all the beings that live in the ocean that have to eat the seafood that's contaminated? All the whales and dolphins have to eat everything that's so contaminated that we're not supposed to eat it, so why would it be okay for them to eat it? This is another one of these sort of glaring elephants in the living room. Yet most people don't pay any attention to this kind of stuff. They keep on eating their fish, especially here in New Zealand. I keep telling people, you know, if people stop supporting the fishing industry, it won't exist. But people love to eat their fish. Some people even think that it's not meat. And if fish isn't meat, I don't know what it is. But part of the modern-day delusion of the island mentality. Then you've got what may be the biggest elephant in the living room of the toxicity dimension, the radiological dimension. All the close to 2,000 synthetic radionuclides from beginning with the splitting of the atom, and all the 2,000 plus atmospheric detonations, all the radioactive waste constantly being produced from reactors and disposed of and deliberately and accidentally all around the world, the astronomical amount of high-level radioactive substances constantly being dumped into the ocean from Fukushima, that sort of dwarfs the whole previous global nuclear scenario along. Yet whoever talks about this, who can dare to even try to understand? And the massive amount of radioactive materials dispersed via depleted uranium that's in the vast majority of all the artillery that any NATO or Western forces use now, not to mention the use of tactical nukes. I mean, how many of us would know if an atomic bomb actually went off somewhere, especially a small one? We have no way of knowing. It's probably happening all the time. So, like Dr. Arnold Lehman said in 1963, he was a contemporary of Rachel Carson, a genetic toxicologist. He said that if we really want to understand the genomic evolutionary effects of what chemical or radiological toxicity is doing to us genetically, we have to study at least 25 generations of people. But we who are alive now are only the third generation of people to exist since all this stuff even came into being. So how can we possibly know what we've unleashed? I mean, we can already see the effects that it's having on us. One of the biggest being, it's creating a massive distortion in our whole cognitive abilities. Along with the presence of boats is another major threat to the whales and dolphins and all of sea life is the global fishing industry, which is out of control here in New Zealand. Pretty much every nation has a massive fishing industry, but if you just think of how many fishing vessels there are and what they actually do, they trawl these giant nets and scrape the bottom of the seafloor and catch everything and throw out whatever they don't want as bycatch. And it could be that hundreds of thousands of whales and dolphins are killed as bycatch every year, which might make fishing bycatch the numerically most recognizably lethal of any industrial process affecting life in the ocean. But, you know, we don't really have any solid records. Again, the people that dredge up the nets, they would have some kind of idea of how many whales and dolphins there are, but the last thing that they want to do is publicize these numbers. The fishing industry is only made possible by the people who eat fish. Think of that. Along with all the shipping and the anthropogenic presence in the ocean, we've got the whole scenario of acoustic contamination or bioacoustic warfare, marine noise. This would come from a wide variety of sources, but anything humans do in the ocean makes noise, unless they're kayaking or surfing or swimming. Anything with a motor makes a vast amount of noise, and elementary physics tells us that sound travels a lot faster and more intensely in water. At this point, I'd really like to introduce the work of Jeff Prideaux, an independent marine researcher that I recently met on Kangaroo Island, South Australia. And I'm putting a link to his paper, where he's gone to a lot of trouble to sort of explain a lot of this basic marine bioacoustics in layman's terms so that people can understand it. But I'm hoping to be able to do an interview with him on his new paper in November. So you've got the noise coming from every ship, and it can be quite loud. I read an article that, this is from maybe a decade ago, that over the years before that, the overall background noise in the ocean had increased by as much as 10 decibels, and I think it would be a lot more than that now. But it's just like a background cacophony of sound that would tend to debilitate the communication abilities of anybody in the ocean that used the sound, not to mention annoyance. I mean, think of yourself. How do you feel when you're forced to listen to some really loud, obnoxious sound or noise that you have to hear it? And it's maybe not even just hearing, but feeling the physical vibration in your body as well. How does that make you feel? Well, think of living in the ocean, a medium that's much more conducive to sound, being exposed to loud sounds and noises all the time. But there's a lot of stuff that people do in the ocean that makes sounds, which I'm about to talk about. One of the biggest threats to whales and dolphins and all life in the ocean, it's a technology called sonar. Sound navigation and ranging, which is technologically originally based on the echolocation of bats and whales and dolphins. But it's really evolved since World War II. To be not just a sensing technology, but an actual weapons technology itself. I was just talking with a retired Australian naval commander in Darwin a few weeks ago, and he said he actually personally witnessed the water around a boat boiling, as in heat, boiling from the sonar that they had turned up really high. So what does that tell you? So if you want to understand how much sonar there is in the world, we need to go back to how many vessels there are. So every vessel of any size, regardless of whether it's commercial, industrial, transport, military, or scientific, is going to have sonar, at least one and probably several of different kinds, different bandwidths, different frequencies, different power levels. The only boats that don't have them are small little, you know, skiffs and launches and stuff that people use to get onto their bigger boats, kayaks and things like that. Even sailboats have sonar. They use it for depth sounding and to detect any kind of objects that might be in your path. But it's one of the things I'm trying to work on with my Holomimic project, is to make a total estimate of how much sonar energy is entering the world's ocean at any given point. And first you'd have to make as accurate of an estimate as possible of the total number of vessels, and then map out what kinds of sonar systems they have, what kind of power levels they're at, how often they tend to be utilized. And you can look at it in terms of watts of energy being pumped into the ocean, but you can look at it in terms of its, not only its acoustic, but its thermal effects too, because ultrasound creates heat. You'd think that sonar would interfere with the natural biological sonars of whales and dolphins and other life forms in the ocean. But again, we have no way of being able to understand. What we do know about is the effects of low frequency and mid-range frequency sonars on whales and dolphins that are operated at very high levels. For example, the low frequency active sonar of the U.S. Navy, which is said to have a kill zone the size of Texas. But, you know, back to the whaling thing, they say that the Japanese whaling fleet in any given year might take off, say, 900 whales, which is 900 individual beautiful lives lost to being murdered by barbarous villains. But technologies exist like these low-frequency active sonar of the navies of the world that deliver an underwater explosion of sound so powerful that it sends out a blast or shockwave that can kill or maim or mutilate or destroy the hearing apparatus of as many whales and dolphins at once from one blast as the whole Japanese whaling fleet could kill in a year, or even more, depending on where the underwater explosion occurred and how many whales and dolphins were in the vicinity. And see, like my beautiful friends at Strandon and Moore pointed out, we have no way of knowing about the vast majority of any whales or dolphins or other sea life that's actually injured or killed at sea, because only 8% or less of their bodies are going to actually wash up on shore. All the rest are going to be eaten or dropped to the bottom or decaying or all of the above. So it's just this giant gray area. This is another reason why people like to focus on the whaling thing, because it's a clear-cut problem solution. That you've got the clear-cut enemy, and you can see what it does, and you can capitalize on it. But it's hard to actually consider the whole global military apparatus. The U.S. Navy, for example, which would be the largest single military entity on the planet. Also, the largest single nuclear entity. In addition to these sonars that you've got probably tens of millions of vessels blasting sonar of different types at any given time all around the world. Anywhere there's human presence in the ocean, there's sonar. Anywhere there's a human presence in the ocean, there's noise. Anywhere there's a human presence in the ocean, there's a physical vehicle. Anywhere there's a human presence in the ocean, there's going to be the leakage of fuel and lubricants. The hydrocarbon exploration companies use to explore for oil and other resources that they're after. It's called seismic testing. And there's many different techniques of geophysical exploration, but seismic testing involves a towed array. That's not an amphibian, but that's T-O-W-E-D. A towed array of transducers, each of which is about the size of a Volkswagen Beetle. And they simultaneously emit these explosions of sound that whose shockwave vibrations go down into the ocean floor, penetrate down in there, and then they bounce back up and are picked up by the hydrophones and analyzed by their computer models to tell them, according to the harmonics that they receive, what kind of substances are down there and what the depths are. It's much more sophisticated than that. But there's probably 600 or 700 seismic exploration vehicles that exist probably a big percentage of those would be in operation around the world at any given time. So the low-frequency active sonar by the world's navies and the seismic testing for hydrocarbons uses a very similar technology. These are towed arrays of transducers that emit sonic explosions. And a lot of the other sonars are mounted within the hulls of the boats. But you've got all this stuff going at the same time. A new process is about to take place, supposedly this year, in Papua New Guinea. It's called deep seabed mining by this renegade Canadian company called Nautilus. And I've talked about this several times. I'd like to thank my friend Barry Lally in Papua New Guinea for his work along this line. It sounds like Nautilus has been having financial difficulties, but this is the prototype project for deep seabed mining, which it's totally robotic. Relying on patents that Lockheed came out with in the 1970s that use these sort of Terminator-looking bulldozer things that crawl along the bottom of the ocean and dig up all these places where all these resources are that they want, like polymetallic sulfides, all kinds of nodules of rare earth metals, all the stuff that like the computer industries and other high-tech industries want. If you look at a map of deep seabed mining, it's just like there's hundreds if not thousands of places mapped out already that they want to go after. And the Nautilus project in PNG is said to be the first, and they're going to see how it works. But the damage from this is going to be unbelievable because it's all got to be transported back up to the surface. It's going to totally destroy whatever environment they're digging, and it's going to create giant clouds of silt and muck and sand and stuff churned up just like dredging would do, and it's going to flow in all the currents and just destroy. It would be like a volcanic eruption on Earth, blotting out your ability to see and breathe. That's going to happen around any deep seabed mining site. So hopefully this is not going to get off the ground, but with all the deep seabed mining permits that have already been handed out for a 6 or 7 figure fee by the self-proclaimed International Seabed Authority branch of the United Nations, giving out deep seabed mining permits all over the world. It's going to start, it's going to happen at some point. So now I'm going to talk about the newest global threat to whales and dolphins that I've really become highly educated about in the past year, thanks to my brilliant friends Dr. Terry, Mr. Limpet Lilly, a marine biologist and underwater photographer in Hawaii, and his fellow researcher, Stuart the Effect Simonson. I really want to thank you guys for your brilliant work and for all that you've shared with me and for the 5 interviews that we've done. I'd really like to do interviews with both of you again really soon. But the basic idea is that Terry's been mapping out the effects of the new generation of microwave weapons being used by the U.S. military and other militaries, and especially the Navy, and especially now in undersea warfare, which is really the going thing now because of submarines. One submarine can carry enough nuclear missiles to destroy every city on the planet. And so, and you don't really know where they are. And a nuclear submarine can stay submerged for probably months at a time. So undersea warfare and this company called Raytheon is probably the world leader in underwater microwave and advanced weapon system sonar technologies. They're involved with the HAARP project in Alaska and all the other spinoffs from that exist now, many of which are in Antarctica and at other polar latitudes. This is this is the technology that makes geophysical warfare possible. That is the engineering of weather, which I think is clearly rampant going on around the world right now, the engineering of artificial earthquakes, and a host of other forms of geoterrorism. But the microwaves, Terry Lilly has clearly demonstrated how the coral reefs off of the North Shore of Kauai were fine until the Navy started broadcasting all this microwave energy, and then the coral reefs turned to mush. But then when they moved all the stuff offshore, the reefs have recovered. So it can't be blamed on climate change. This is what we've talked about in numerous shows over the past year. Stuart VFX Simonson's work has focused on the electromagnetic fields or currents emanated by all marine vessels of any size. They're called cathodic protection systems that generate electric currents of probably thousands of amps, that they're electrifying the hull of the boat, supposedly to prevent corrosion because of the action of the salt water on the metal. The galvanic interaction is corrosive. But he's been so highly educational to me. Corrosion can happen in biological systems too. That's what's happening with the corals. And other things that of calcium carbonate are, they interact electronically with the electric fields of these cathodic protection systems. Well, you've got several different factors. You've got the proximity of a lot of these vessels in the shipping lanes, for example, that could possibly render a shipping lane as sort of a giant electrified conduit. Then you've also got the fact that the U.S. Navy has taken the same technology and weaponized it by raising the power level so high that if someone tries to swim in the ocean near a U.S. military boat, they're likely to get electrocuted. That actually happened with Terry Lilly. So this is stuff I've talked about on numerous shows. But when you look at the total amount of the microwave energy, I mean, I'd strongly suggest that you look at the Raytheon website about what they're doing with undersea warfare. This is like the domain of what most people think can only exist in science fiction. The militarized ocean, according to Admiral William Nirenberg, the militarized ocean seeks an ocean free of biological interference. That is, any organisms large enough to cast a sonar echo or shadow that could interfere with effective war fighting. So what does that tell you about the whole mentality of the military? They don't care what they kill. They just want to perform effective war fighting. You know, so this leads me to the single greatest threat to life in the ocean is the whole military-industrial complex. The whole military planetary apparatus and everything that makes it possible, which is really interlinked with everything, almost all aspects of industry, academia, and finance. It's all one giant mega technology. But the whole military scenario, people have no idea of how vast it is. This is what Dr. Rosalie Bertel was starting to make one small step towards, an understanding of this giant, essentially invisible mega technology that's all over the world. I mean, if you look at the U.S. alone, probably 1,000 U.S. bases exist. And this is just a formal base. This is not support facilities. This is not research and development. This is not the office of all the corporations that make it possible. This is not the administrative offices. It's everywhere. Their agenda is to dominate every dimension of the earth, whether it's physical, social, or mental. Full-spectrum dominance of the atmosphere, control of the weather, control of space, control of communication, control of electronic transmission, control of the land, control of the surface of the ocean, control of the submarine environment. I mean, this is just what we know about. So I'm going to run down the list again. First and least, we have whaling as a threat to the whales and dolphins. Then we've got chemical and radiological toxicity. Then we've got the physical presence from shipping lanes and vessels, strikes from boats and propellers. We've got the acoustic pollution and noise. We've got the fishing industry. We've got the specter of deep seabed mining. We've got sonar in all its forms and seismic testing and other geophysical exploration techniques. And we've got the whole electromagnetic radiation and microwave scenario. All of this ties in together as part of the global military-industrial presence in the ocean and on the whole planet. It's a giant parasitic growth that's just literally sucking out the lifeblood of everything on this planet. Everything is secondary to it. It's got its own budget that dwarfs the civilian economy. It's immune to all environmental regulations. All of humanity basically has been brainwashed into not even seeing it, not questioning its validity or its existence at all, not even asking questions about all the billions of dollars or trillions of dollars that are spent on ever-increasing, increasingly sophisticated weapons technologies. It's the elephant in the living room of all elephants in the living room on this planet in terms of what people are doing, and it may be that it's totally beyond human control. The whole military-industrial juggernaut may be running on a giant network of computers that's actually got a sort of artificially intelligent mind of its own, which is the subject of another show. But all these are sort of the causes of ill effects in marine life. What are some of the effects? Well, they could be illnesses of all different kinds, some we might understand, most of which we wouldn't. In the whales and dolphins, physical, it could create mental illness in them from disturbance, annoyance. It could create debilitated immune systems, all the effects that you'd expect from living in a very toxic environment, a noisy environment. You've got the toxic burden building up in their bodies, just like we have, of chemical and radiological contaminants in our bones and all our cells. We've got the psychological dimensions of them being annoyed by our presence, by the whale-watching industry and dolphin-watching that chases them around, and people taking photographs. They're trying to have some peace and quiet with their little babies, and we just won't let them. Their lack of privacy, the disruption of their behaviors of whatever it is they want to do, the disruption of their communication by all the noise and the microwaves. They might have a ringing in their ears from all the microwaves, just like we get. They have cuts and bruises and giant gaping gashes in their dorsal fins and their backs from propeller contact. They're having all their foods poisoned and stolen by the fishing industry. These are just a few of the real global threats to the whales and dolphins. And I think that they really want us to hear this information, because I don't think we have it in our power to stop doing all this stuff, even if we wanted to. And the sad thing is, most people don't even want to. But if you walk around with this more accurate information as part of your model of what's really going on, and try to at least reduce your contribution to these things, we're not going to stop what the Hopis call the Day of Purification, which is what I call the Atlantean discontinuity. It's whatever Mother Earth and the Great Spirit has to do to get rid of this kind of human presence on the planet. I think it's going to come like a thief in the night, in the flash or the blink of an eye, in ways that we don't even understand. But like Thomas Bunyaki said, we can hope to possibly lessen the severity of the purification by all the good things that we do. Mother Earth and the Great Spirit know each of our hearts and minds. So try to truly live simply so that others may simply live. It was on this exact little island, Memory Island, where I am right now, where Elizabeth Verstraten and I recorded the scene at the end of our little film, Ihi Tohora Wananga, that shows her burning a piece of sage with the sunrise, and it says, we think this is the basic message of the whales and dolphins to us now. Live simply so that others may simply live. That's what I'll leave you with now. Hey, wahi tapu, wahi arahi mai, inya tahora me inya ihi. This is Jeff Weverson signing off for On the Brink Radio. I love you guys, and tune into the whales and dolphins, because they love us a lot.